We're going to not call the meeting to order since we're a little light on members, but the public is here, so we're ready to work. I wish you all happy St. Patrick's Day, and as a person who's probably 1/8 Irish of the Daly Clan, I want to acknowledge that's why I'm wearing my green wristband. So, anyway, Representative Huntley, you want to start your testimony, and then we'll move your bill when we get a call.
Well, Mr. Chair, in some parts of Ireland, a orange shirt does not go well with the people.
Oh, yeah. Good. Thanks for the warning.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I won't move this till we get a quorum, but 2614 is, again, an attempt to save some money in the healthcare system. This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion, and it basically says that we will look at the highest 5% spenders that we spend on medical assistance and provide them with intensive care management so we can hopefully reduce some of those expenses. There will be an amendment that says that this would start at 18 years because the Children's Hospital, particularly Gillette, close to 100% of their patients are in this top 5% because that's the kind of people that go to the children's hospitals. So we're going to just say for 18 and older, those people that are in the top 5% of spending will be subject to an intensive care management to try to save some dollars. I do know that the Courage Center supports this bill, and they like the idea. Again, that's sort of what they do is intensive care management and try to reduce the cost for these patients. And I think with that, I would be happy to. What it does is take the money for that 5% and puts it into a fund so that it can be used for intensive care management. Okay. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Actually, we can actually move we're going to call the meeting to order. Okay. And Representative Huntley moves House File 2614 be held for possible inclusion. And I'll move your amendment for you. Then he also moves the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment I would move.
And you want to, just moves it off into the future and talks about age 18?
Yeah, it does two things. One, we would need a waiver to implement this, so we have to delay the time at which it starts. That's what the date changes are, and it also excludes children from this particular bill. So the Children's Hospital asked me to put that amendment in there, and I was happy to do that after they explained it to me.
Thanks. Representative Thiessen.
Thanks. So just thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't see where this fund is set up. I see the reduction in spending. And I see $15,000 appropriated to set up the program, but I don't. But maybe I'm missing.
Well,
Huntley,
we are assuming there will be savings, and so that's I guess I misspoke when said there'd be a separate fund. I don't know if Mr. Pollack would like to.
So, Representative, Mr. Chair, so we're actually saving money.
Yeah.
By doing this, so we're just reducing appropriations, assuming this program's going to save money.
Yeah, so that is correct,
Representative Huntley.
Representative Thiessen, but we do not have a fiscal note yet, yeah. And so that's what we're waiting for.
Representative Thiessen.
And then I guess the only question I always have is why wouldn't people be doing this already without us having to tell them to do it? But that's more rhetorical,
that rhetorical
than anything.
We can ask them to come up and tell
more
them.
Republican according to my friend there. So there we go. All right.
Representative Emery, you want to offer some advice to the rhetorical question?
We're in agreement.
Bipartisan. This is everybody loves your bill, I guess. Maybe that's not the message. Representative Huntley.
If I could answer that, it's because the payment system we have doesn't reward them for doing that kind of thing.
Okay, there we go. All right.
And is actually to the amendment, any committee discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendments adopted. To the bill, is there somebody in the audience who, there's nobody signed up, but if somebody wants to testify to this, this is your opportunity for any public discussion. They're not running down here, Representative Huntley. One of the pages wishes to testify. Okay. And well, I'm going to offer just a comment. I think this is the kind of thing that we had better be about doing, and from my experience, be involved with many health plans. They don't do a lot of management, and we need to help them move in that direction. It used to be that when we had a managed care, we took 5% savings, and that has gone away compared to the fee-for-service. And so I think working with the advocates and the plans, and this is a way to manage our budget challenges without causing any harm to any client. So, any other anybody want to testify about this or comments on the Representative Thiessen?
So this is health plans that would do this, or would it be providers that would do this?
Representative Huntley, do you know?
Or it'd be both.
It would be both, I think, because what we're doing is we're setting up a different way to treat these people, and it could be either through the plans or the fee-for-service system.
Well, Representative, the department did have a letter that they put out. Does anybody from the department want to talk about this? They're shaking their head no. This is actually a good time to bring objections forward because we can fix them, but if you don't want to talk about it, I'm comfortable with you not wanting to talk about it. So with that, the bill's held over for possible inclusion.
Next, we have House File 3442. The authors are Representative Hosh and Representative Huntley. And again, these were both these bills are the previous one and this one are looking at all kinds of possible ways to reduce spending in the Health and Human Service area. And they will reduce spending, but they also may cause serious harm. So we're going to have a lot of people testify, and I would like them to limit their testimony to about 3 minutes apiece. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 3442 is a far-reaching bill that affects individuals and affects providers and agencies in dramatic ways. The reason why I thought it was important to discuss these issues, one, is we need to look at doing things a little differently. Instead of doing cuts with simple across-the-board cuts, we need to look at different mechanisms in which we may be able to make the impact more acceptable for those who can accept cuts the most, to try to minimize the impacts on those who are most vulnerable. But also, we need to have a further discussion about where we are with our budget. The governor cut $192 million, $193 million from Health and Human Services with the general fund. And we don't have a target here as a committee at this point, but I can do math. And I can see the $313 million that have been cut with other budget areas of the state budget and the $387 million that the governor and I assume this legislature will accept from federal dollars. And that leaves us with the potential of over $300 million of cuts. And we need to come to a realization in order to reach that amount, what it might mean to people and to providers. And it's quite scary. House File 3442 is meant to start that discussion, start having those ideas, and also to find out how it impacts people, individuals, and agencies. I'll just do a real quick run through. Those who are testifying today will probably be able to explain the impacts that it's going to have on them much more succinctly than I ever could. Section 1 of the bill increases license fees for home care providers substantially, at least double the license fees, and those fees are put into the general fund. Section 2 requires nursing assistants to pay a $50 registration fee, and these also go into the general fund. The Department of Health has just contacted me that CMS has concluded that this is actually illegal, so this is an area in which we might need to remove from the bills at some time. Ideally, hopefully, none of these things have to happen, but this is one area that if we have to consider some of the provisions of the bill that we probably can't do.
Representative Hosh and members, there was an amendment put on in the policy committee, and that is not reflected in the copy that you have, so we're trying to get newer copies.
Yes.
You deleted a number of sections, and they're still in this version.
Mr. Chair, my summary is on the engrossed version. The changes that we made in the policy committee removed transitional counseling requirements, and also we removed a Medicare carve-out that we had for trying to calculate per diems. So those aren't in the engrossed version that I'm going through, but I understand that your copy is the original version of the bill. Section 3 increases fees for housing with services from $155 to $2,000. The Department of Health also has concerns with this, as it removes all fee revenue from special government revenue accounts into the general fund. Section 4 requires that information be provided to the commissioner regarding what services are included in the base rate that will be paid by residents for customized living or housing with services. Section 5 has some changes for housing with service contracts, making sure that a contract include a delineation of the portion of the base rate that constitutes rent, and also delineating what in that rate is for services. Section 6 of the bill is housing with services establishments shall provide information to all prospective and current residents. That's consistent with the Uniform Consumer Information Guide. Section 7 deals with termination of leases, and that if a lease is terminated, that the resident is included information about the ombudsman for long-term care and contact information of how they can contact the ombudsman if their lease is terminated. Section 8 requires the information guide to provide information about which services are what services are covered by Medicare. Section 9 deals with the senior linkage line, and it requires the senior linkage line to provide consumer information on price comparisons, delineation of charges for rent and what charges were for services, and also to provide that information to the commissioner so the commissioner can try to align the data to provide more comparison of long-term care options for individuals using the services. The next sections is probably the meat of the bill and what's most controversial. Section 10 accelerates the two activity of daily living requirement to be eligible for personal care assistance services. Last year, we had substantial changes to PCA services. One of the changes that we had is that it would require two ADLs for somebody to be eligible for PCA services starting July 1st, 2011. Members, this is a significant impact to a lot of people. Right now, preliminary numbers show us that this could result in 2,400 people losing PCA services. One of the components that we had in the legislation last year was to require the department to do some transition planning for these individuals. If we were to accelerate this requirement to 2010, that transition planning would not be ready to be rolled out in serving those who would lose PCA services. Section 11 is requiring a personal care assistant to pay a registration fee of $50. Section 12 is essentially assisted living rate reductions. For those who are in the policy committee, we talked about the concentration of assisted living facilities per 1,000 people, and that Minnesota is by far and away has the highest concentration of assisted living facilities per 1,000. The study that we gave you did have some methodology flaws, so I want to make that clear, but even with those methodology flaws taken into account, Minnesota still has substantially higher concentration than any other state in the union. And we have to have a discussion on that. And one of the things that this bill tries to provide a discussion on is, can we cut rates in this area? And the counties that have a lower concentration, can we reduce the rate cut for them while having a higher rate cut for areas that have a higher concentration, with the assumption that the areas with the higher concentration are able to absorb a rate cut more easily than maybe a rural area or a county that has lower concentration of assisted living. Section 13 is one of the bright components of this bill, and that's phasing in rebasing for nursing homes. That was a delay that we did last year with budget cuts. Rebasing recalculates rates based on cost for nursing homes, and that's something that we haven't done for a long time, in which we haven't based our reimbursements on cost. We've simply done a cost of living adjustment or a rate cut, and the current reimbursements do not reflect cost and also promote greater disparities throughout the state when it comes to nursing home reimbursements. Section 14 does a nursing home rate cut anywhere from 1% to 3%. And the rate cut is based on the payer mix of the nursing home. For a nursing home that has a larger proportion of private pay residents, they would receive a larger rate cut. For a nursing home with a lower proportion of private pay residents, they would receive a reduced rate cut down to 1%. And this really mixes in with Section 15, which phases out equalization. And equalization is the requirement that we have that nursing homes, the MA reimbursement sets the rates for all of their payers, private pay and MA recipients. Essentially, what we're talking about here is we have two decisions. If we're going to cut nursing homes, we've got two different things we can do. One is we can keep equalization, do a rate cut, and we are cutting 100% of nursing home reimbursements. If we phase out equalization, instead of cutting 100% of the reimbursement, we might only have to cut 70% or 75% of their reimbursement, because their private pay portion wouldn't be subject to that equalization law. And that's a debate we're going to have as a legislature. We can essentially, one of the options that we could do is even temporarily suspending equalization and doing a rate cut and just freezing private pay at the current rate where nobody pays a penny more. I don't know if that's the right answer, but we have to have this discussion, because if we're going to have a substantially higher target than the general fund cuts that the governor recommends, there's going to have to be some substantial decisions that we make. So, Mr. Chair, that is my bill, and I am more than happy to listen to any of the concerns or criticisms that folks may have on this.
Okay, we have a lot of people signed up, and before we get to questions, why don't we hear from people in the audience. So first is Craig Acom from the Department of Health. Then we'll have hopefully somebody from DHS. Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, Representative Hosh. My name, for the record, is Craig Acom. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Health for the department. As Representative Hosh mentioned, we have a few structural concerns with the way the bill is written. So I'm sure there's people in the audience with other concerns that they'll bring up. The first is in the first three sections to relate directly to the Department of Health. The first section increases all of our Class F license fees. As many of you know, the Department of Health has many regulatory responsibilities, and we establish and set fees on our regulated communities based on statutory responsibilities and actual program costs. This is an arbitrary increase, nearly a doubling of our fees, not tied to any increase in responsibility, activity, or costs, and has not involved discussions with our regulated fee payers. We feel that this could negatively impact our ability to request fee increases in the future when they're actually needed to maintain our program operations. This particular fee increase leaves the extra funding with the department, and frankly, we don't need that at this time. The second one is Representative Hosh mentioned, adds a new fee, second section, adds a new fee to the nursing assistant registry. We have an opinion from CMS, from their Office of the Inspector General, Office of Evaluation and Inspections Review, that this is in violation of federal law. And it violates federal law in two places. Section 1919E2C of the Social Security Act states that the state may not impose any charges on a nurse aide relating to the registry established and maintained under Section 1919E2A. And in addition, 42 CFR Section 483.186B4 prohibits the state from imposing any charges related to registration on individuals listed in the registry. And so our third concern is with Section 3, which increases the Housing with Services registration fee and then transfers all of the fee revenue to the general fund. This includes both the increase and the existing revenue that we receive to do our Housing with Services activities at the Department of Health. We would no longer be able to support any of our responsibilities around Housing with Services, and we also strongly oppose the use or transfer of fee revenue under the authority given us to set fees for regulatory activities for purposes not related to the program for which the fee authority was given. And so we feel that this would be a way of using our existing fee-setting authority solely for the purposes of those regulatory activities for purposes other than our regulatory purposes. So,
questions for Commissioner Acob? I will say that the governor's budget proposal does have a lot of money coming out of various license fees and boards that but we certainly would not do what the CMS would not allow us to do. Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anybody here from DHS that would like to talk?
Hi. My name is Carrie Erber, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. And I'm just going to quickly go over a memo that we sent to Representative Hosh on issues with the bill that we had. And some of the issues have been taken care of because there was were some amendments. Let's see. In Section 7, there's a piece in there about additional responsibilities for the ombudsman, and it would require two FTEs on reviewing lease terminations. So that was one piece. Section on the PCA eligibility change, and what section was that's changed since the bill?
Section 10.
This change, or this part of the bill, moves up PCA services 1 year earlier. The change is in making it two ADLs instead of one ADL. And part of the problem with this is there's a problem for managed care on the effective date. Generally, they renew their contracts on January 1st, so there's sometimes issues, or there's issues with that. There's also policy concerns. There's approximately 1,500 to 2,000 people that would become ineligible for PCA, and this might create a crisis for them. And also the 2009 PCA reforms are still being implemented. And so it would require lead agencies to reassess people who would become ineligible for PCAs. Appeals would increase. We've had appeals over the current laws. DHS is already receiving 100 plus appeals per week. And then I also mentioned this earlier, but the bill does not provide time for managed care plans to make contract changes. Section 11, I think it is now, 50, the PCA registration fee, this can be implemented, but there is a small programming and admin costs, and we would have to work out how those fees would be collected. We were initially thinking that they would have to go through their current electronic system, but we'd have to work out, you know, if we did manual checks or that type of collection process, we'd have to add another FTE. On the rate reduction for customized living, there are no percents in that bill at this point, so we would have to add that in there. And depending on what reduction that we use, it could cause more people to go into nursing facilities. And then we also, the Medicare influence portion was removed, so we don't have that issue. The phase-in and nursing facility rebasing can be implemented, and it was fiscal noted. The nursing facility rate reduction, that section can be implemented in fiscal noted. And then also, on the nursing facility rate equalization phase-out, that section can be implemented, but the language is different than the governor's budget. And actually, I think we clarified that, but there's a slight cost in the out-years. So basically, those were the items that we brought forward as an issue.
Questions? Representative Abler.
Well, just in a tangential issue, since you're talking about appeals, I remember last year when we did this, the changes in the PCA, there was talk about appeals and that they would, can you just give us a couple sentences on how that's going? Are the appeals being upheld at the department level, or are they prevailing, or is that, because there were some savings that we took for this, and so can you comment about that?
Yeah, I'm going to have somebody come up and answer that.
Just a short response is all I'm looking for now. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Abler, we have been looking at, we have about over 100 appeals a week at this point. It started out relatively, you know, 50-ish or so. It's come up to about over 100 now a week. So we are going through the appeals in terms of how the law has allowed the appeals judges to be making decisions, and that has helped a lot in terms of being able to clarify or be very the decisions are more easily made, I think, not easily, but they're made based on the law that's there rather than arguing over different minutes and things like that. So is there some more specific, were you asking about?
Mr. Chair. Yeah. Oh, just like, well, what percent are prevailing and what percent are not? And just have you heard these at court yet? Or
if you could state your name for the tape, too.
My name is Pam Merkel. I'm with the Department of Human Services. Representative Abler, I have not heard what those percentages are at this time.
Other questions? So Representative Thiessen.
Just a quick one on the PCA piece. So when people are assessed today, are they assessed for one or two ADLs? And why do we have to reassess if we're going from two to one? Wouldn't we already know that?
Representative Thiessen, yes, we do. We are currently assessing everybody from January through July. We are in the process. Actually, the lead agencies are in the process of assessing everybody. And we will know how many people will not meet that threshold. But we would offer them a reassessment to see if things have changed since the past assessment in order to make sure that they are not leaving PCA services without at least the opportunity to be reassessed. So there would be the number of people who would no longer be eligible with the current criteria as of July 1st would be the only ones that would have to be reassessed. So it would be between the 1,500 and 2,000 people.
And Mr. Chair, when we say have to be reassessed, is that like a due process kind of thing? Or, I mean, if we just assess people, is that what it comes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, yes, because we would want to make sure that there weren't any other changes since their last assessment. People are being reassessed right now, and there could be changes in there.
In 3 months?
Well, some have been reassessed back in December. Some have been assessed in January. Some have been assessed in February. So.
Okay.
Other questions? I don't see any, so thank you. And then we'll go to the next is Christine Bakke from St. Benedict's Senior Community.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if it's all right with you, we had planned our testimony together, if that's all right. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm with Aging Services of Minnesota and here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. And with me today is Christine Bakke, the Care Center Administrator with St. Benedict's Senior Community in St. Cloud, Minnesota, as well as Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota. All three of us are here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. And we've sort of split our testimony, so you're going to hear from each one of us on various different aspects of the bill. So let me just provide a few introductory framing remarks before turning it over to Christine and Toby. While we appreciate the conversation that Representative Hosh is trying to have here this year, and we certainly recognize the budget pressures that all of you face, and we know that you have no easy decisions this year, we can only characterize House File 3442 as one of the most onerous bills that we have ever seen in years with regard to older adult services. And we don't make that characterization lightly. As I told members of the policy committee last week, we are opposed to nearly every provision in the bill, and we certainly will express some of our opposition today. In your packets, you should have received a more extensive discussion of some of the major provisions in the bill, and we'd be happy to outline our opposition to any of the provisions in the bill, but you can, excuse me, take a look at that as well. We would like to focus our testimony on three major areas for today, however. The first area would be rate equalization and the repeal. It is one provision that we do support in the bill. And then the second provision are the rate cuts to care centers, and then finally, excuse me, the rate cuts to housing with services units. And that's how we will proceed with our testimony today. So with that, I will first turn it over to Christine Bakke to discuss the repeal of rate equalization. Thank you, Mr.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. My name is Christine Bakke. I am the Care Center Administrator at St. Benedict Senior Community, as Carrie mentioned. As a care center, we too are suffering a dire crisis as far as our financial situation goes, and most care centers in the state of Minnesota are suffering that. In my facility, in my care center, 18% of my resident days are covered by Medicare. So the remaining 82% of the resident days are controlled through reimbursement that is set by the state of Minnesota. A total of 38% of my resident days are private pay, which is actually a relatively high percent for care centers. For us, the repeal of rate equalization will be the difference between some very difficult choices. The highest expense center that I have is with my staff. It is with salaries and benefits and wages. It's the only place that I can go and that I have absolute control over the costs. So without the ability to find more revenues in the face of cuts, we would have no alternative but to look at cutting hours, reducing wages, or reducing benefits. And this is a place that nobody wants to go when you look at the average wage of what my staff are currently making. We all know that when we have less staff on our floors, when we have people who cannot hardly make a livable wage, we're not able to attract, and ultimately the people who pay the price are our residents. They have longer waits, we have unhappy staff, and it's not a very good situation, and we've been facing this for years. There are many people who are opposed to the repeal of equalization, and many of the arguments I find to be not valid. One of the concerns is people bring up that there would be discrimination. The federal government sets guidelines to prevent us from discriminating. Under the conditions of participation, 483.12C1, it is very specific that a care center that participates in Medicare and Medicaid must have policies for admission, transfer, discharge, and the provision of services regardless of source of payment. We also have federal regulations that when the Department of Health comes out to survey, they can cite us for deficiencies, including that particular one. They range from F-150 to F-522. That's a lot of regulations that can be cited to us if we are not providing a minimum threshold of care to everyone. I guarantee the Department of Health is not going to ask a resident what their payment source is to determine how to apply the federal laws. At the Health and Human Services Committee last week, it was asked about private rooms and access to private rooms. Minnesota does pay us a percentage to have medical assistance residents in our private rooms. Our private pay population is small enough that we can't fill all of our private rooms with just private paying residents. There is equal access. There are equal practices regardless of payment source, and we've been seeing that for years in our nursing homes in Minnesota. People are concerned about, will we accelerate the spend down of our private paying residents and therefore put them on medical assistance earlier? The average length of stay in nursing homes is 268 days. That was, I believe, 2 years ago, and it's decreasing, and every year it decreases. That's less than 9 months right now. If you looked at the median, it was about 38 days. An increase in private pay rates, it will only further delay people's admissions to nursing homes. There is so much access in the community that people do not choose to come to nursing homes until they absolutely have to. It is the place of last resort. And as we're seeing length of stay decreasing, accelerating spend down becomes not as big of an issue. There's another concern about, would there be uncontrolled increases to private pay? Well, right now we can only charge what the market will bear. If there's a difference of $20 per day with our private pay, we do have competition. We can't just raise our rates $20 a day. We can't do that. In the proposal, it's a 2% increase in the first year. In my facility, that's $3.50 a day. There's another concern about cost shifting, so that the private paying residents would pay to make up for the losses on Medicaid. My position is people should have to pay the full price for the services they receive. There is no other health care provider in Minnesota that must offer their Medicaid discount to a private paying client. An example is a hospital. They offer discounts to people who are uninsured, but it's off their charges. It is not off of cost. There are no other industries in Minnesota that contract with the government that gives a government discount to us, the consumer. So my plea to you today is please, please consider the repeal of rate equalization. It is a 30-year-old law. It does not apply in Minnesota anymore. Providers will not discriminate, and length of stay is decreasing because people are not coming to nursing homes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
And we're running on time here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota, testifying on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. We oppose the cuts because of the adverse economic impact of the cuts. Investments in long-term care strengthen our economy and protect our seniors. Long-term care supports 112,600 jobs in the state of Minnesota. That's about a $6.7 billion contribution to the economy. In short, many communities, older adult service providers are the vital economic engine within those communities. They employ people. They take care of people. I'd like to just briefly address the cuts to nursing homes. The real question of the payment reform we have advocated for is cost coverage. This is what rebasing is trying to address. We appreciate the efforts of the author to continue the implementation of rebasing. This is a vital step in reforming the payment system of long-term care and trying to achieve covering costs. Changing to a policy of cuts based on percent of private payers is troublesome. In summary, the policy of picking winners and losers based on anything external is a road that associations simply cannot go down. The current shortfall is $20 a day. We cannot exacerbate this shortfall basing cuts on anything. While we recognize that you have difficult financial times, it's been the position of the imperative that if there are cuts, the cuts should be as shallow as possible, spread across as many people as possible. Thank you.
And then finally, Mr. Chair, and I am aware of the time, but just very briefly on the rate cuts proposed to customized living and 24-hour customized living. The unspecified rate cuts to elderly waiver customized living and 24-hour customized living that's proposed in this bill would be based on the density of housing with services beds per age 65 and over in a county and contiguous counties. I would draw attention to the fiscal note that you've received and the comments provided by Sue Bankin in the memo attached to that fiscal note, where even the department agrees that the proposed methodology of cuts in this bill would not even address or achieve the results that have been identified by the bill's author and others. Let's be clear here that the long-term care imperative does not endorse any methodology that picks winners and losers. And if this committee deems that elderly waiver does need to take rate cuts, we would oppose the sort of methodology proposed in this bill. We would also like to note that the elderly waiver program, as well as other waivered programs, contributed a substantial amount to the budget solution last year. In addition to a 2.5% rate cut last year, there are constant changes going on at the Department of Human Services that have resulted in additional reductions to the elderly waiver rate and has an impact on care and those rates. And so we want to be aware that any decisions made in the budget should be looked at carefully as a piling on of already additional reductions already made. One such example is the Elderly Waiver Customized Living Rate Setting Tool that has been recently implemented to eliminate rate disparities across the state as mandated by CMS. The methodology proposed by this bill is in conflict with that tool, and so we need to be careful of those interactions as well. We'd be happy to take questions. This is a complicated bill. It's a long bill, and there's a lot of not fun things in there. So we'd be happy to take questions, and aware of the time, we'll cut short our testimony at this time.
Any of the three, would you, I mean, the governor's got a 2.5% cut, and is that better than what's proposed in this bill, or worse?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are still trying to understand some of the methodologies proposed in this bill. Certainly, there aren't cut amounts necessarily specified in this bill. We are still trying to figure out how it will impact providers across the state, because certainly we want to, in these tough decision times, we also want to make sure that we minimize the pain on providers. Our general principle is that you minimize the pain by spreading it out as much as possible, rather than picking winners and losers. But I don't think today that we are prepared to tell you the best possible way to cut us at this time, and certainly our general principle is that we're opposed to cuts.
And would your organization support an MA surcharge increase, which captures federal money?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the current position of the imperative is that we oppose increases to the surcharge. Right now, the surcharge goes to the general fund, and not a dime of it goes to older adult services or is directly directed to older adult services. Certainly, we would engage in the conversation and look at that, but that's our current position.
I'd just like to add to that, Mr. Chair, that we, based on the feedback that we received after this, the introduction of this bill, we certainly were looking at the different revenue raisers that have been proposed, whether it be the increase in the surcharge or the number of fees outlined within this proposal. It is an ongoing conversation topic with both care providers as well as aging services, but I don't think at this time we've heard directly from our imperative board to go ahead and say yes to any one of those proposals.
Representative Scalzi.
Just briefly, and I heard a few things in that you said, you know, like not fun cuts, and I serve on four finance committee, so there's no fun here this year, and spreading out the pain, but you know that we're on a deadline here, and you know that we've got a terrible deficit coming up after this year, so if you're not prepared to give us ideas of how we could cut instead of this, you're going to have to do it before we have to get these budgets in place. I mean, it's the political reality this year. And there is no new revenue, and we have to figure out some way to make cuts. And I don't know how you would say spread out the pain, or I don't know what that would mean in your vocabulary, but you should let us know. We should know what you mean by that.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Scalzi, certainly we're aware of the deadlines you all have, and certainly we will continue trying to understand this bill. and to make the analysis, and we certainly will, we want to be engaged in those conversations and work cooperatively with the legislature as well.
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, do we have any more testifiers?
Oh, we got a whole bunch.
I'll save my questions until after we're done.
Okay, any other questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. And next, we have Catherine Tenbrook. Probably pronounced wrong.
No, Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Kathy Tenbrook. Correct? Thank you. I'm the coordinator to end homelessness for the city of Minneapolis and Hennepin County, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. With me today are two colleagues who will just be available for questions. In case you have questions, they won't be testifying as well. Kristen Brown from St. Stephen's Human Services and Pamela Coins from Hennepin County. Thank you for the opportunity to speak and express some very serious concerns my colleagues and I have about just Section 3 of the bill, the part of the bill that would raise the annual registration fees on housing with services establishments from $155 a year to $2,000 a year. In Hennepin County, as in many counties throughout the state, we have a plan to end homelessness. And in partnership with the state, we have ended homelessness for some of the longest-term homeless individuals and families. Our plan has broad political and community support, and we have been particularly successful in building relationships with private landlords throughout the community who've been willing to accept people who are experiencing homelessness into their units. Our very talented nonprofit providers give support to both the tenant and the landlord to make sure that that relationship works very well. So despite the economic downturn and the slowdown in new housing development, we have housed nearly 400 of the long-term homeless households in the existing market. In Hennepin County, our nonprofit providers, and not the landlords themselves, are the ones who register the buildings where we place clients with disabilities who are also homeless. The nonprofits do that in order to receive the group residential housing rate that those clients are eligible for in those buildings. We currently have 150 buildings registered, and so at the current rate of $155 a year, that would be $23,560, which our nonprofits pay now, which frankly is already a little bit challenging, but they do it. This bill would increase the fee to $2,000 for each building each year and would jump our nonprofit's responsibility on the fees to over $304,000. So once again, this is the amount the nonprofits pay, not the landlords. This would essentially dismantle our entire housing program as we know it. These nonprofits could not afford to sustain the buildings that we have, let alone register any further buildings to house more people who are experiencing homelessness. And that may just be an unintended consequence of this bill. In addition, I have been working with our Downtown Business Association, the Downtown Council, as well as the Downtown Faith Communities to raise private money to hire more housing case managers to do the same kind of work, where we register buildings, work with landlords, and get people into housing. So we've raised about $350,000 in private investment to do that. If this bill were to pass, we would basically have to end that private partnership because we could no longer afford to register the buildings. So if you do decide to act on this bill, we would hope you would accept an amendment that would exempt the fee from the buildings that we're using to end homelessness for people in our community. So thank you for your time and for your consideration. And if you have questions, I have a couple of experts here who could answer them.
Questions? Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for coming over, Ms. Tenbrook and others. I'm very concerned about this provision. I have worked with you and others on getting people out of long-term homeless, which kind of by definition, at least for the state, is that you had to be homeless one continuous year or four times in the last 3 years, just so we know the group that we're talking about. And so I am very concerned that those folks end up back on the street if they don't have a place to live. And that we then exacerbate the problem. But I do have one question that I just don't, a technical question. How often do we register these buildings? Is it a one-time fee? Is it annually? Or how often do we do this?
Well, it is an annual fee, but I can let Kristen maybe answer the frequency of it.
Hi, I'm Kristen Brown from St. Stephen's Human Services in Minneapolis. We pay $155 for each building we register, and that is an annual fee, and they need to be re-registered each July. So if I were to register a building today, I would have to renew that registration for on July 1st, 2010, and then on an annual basis after that.
Mr. Chair, so it's not on a prorated basis, it simply is just a one-time fee in July?
Correct. It would be $155 today, and then it would be $155 every July after that, that we want to maintain that registration.
So, Mr. Chair, if we had the $2,000 fee and you registered a building today, you would then have to pay $2,000 again in July.
In 2010, and then every year after that.
Okay. And just to be clear, if you didn't have the ability to register these buildings, that means that we wouldn't be able to take advantage of the GRH rate, right? So it's a revenue issue as well. Okay. Well, that makes sense. I understand what we're trying to do here, but I just think that this provision in the bill, we need some work, and I'd be more than willing to work with the author and you guys to figure out what would be the rate. Plus, I'm a little worried about you're not being able to prorate it depending upon when the building got registered. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? I don't see any. So thank you for your testimony. And I always like to remind people that homeless people aren't for free. They still cost the cities and counties a lot of money.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we have Bruce Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM. We're an association of providers who support people with disabilities in a number of program areas. A number of the points that I would have made have been covered by the imperative and the previous testifier, but I do want to focus on two things that's in the bill. The first is what we were just talking about, the registration fee. Representative Thiessen is carrying reform legislation forward that would allow people and allow providers to move folks who are high functioning out of more costly foster care waivered services into programs like Housing with Services. We're working on various incentives and getting rid of disincentives to do that so that people can get their services they need and want, but not the whole panoply of services that are required now under foster care. In other words, more cost effective for everybody. The $2,000, about 12 plus fold increase, would be a severe disincentive for providers to open up this option that would ultimately, if it's cost effective and without that enormous increase, be more cost effective in providing services to thousands of people in Minnesota. So we ask you to take a real hard look at that. The other is on section 11, the registration fee for PCAs. It strikes me that it's a lot to ask of a person who's making $12, $10, $9 an hour to pay up front, after taxes, almost a full day's pay to be able to work as a PCA. This provision would greatly undermine the problems we already have in recruiting and retaining qualified people to provide direct care supports to people with disabilities across Minnesota. So with that, those are my two points. I know you have a lot of time, but hope you consider those as you move forward, and I stand for questions.
Questions for Mr. Nelson? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony.
Chair.
And next is Steve Larson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson, the Public Policy Director for the ARC of Minnesota, and joining me today for some brief comments is Kurt Rutzen, a volunteer advocate. And I have a handout. If I lost the page again. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. These budgets on the backs of persons with disabilities are insane, I think. PCAs need, persons with disabilities need PCAs, and some need them 24/7. And to cut these PCAs would be an incredible injustice to people with disabilities. How many of you wait to go to the restroom, like maybe an hour or two until a PCA comes? I just would challenge you guys to think about that kind of thing, because that's what's happening today with these cuts. And down the road, it would just get 5 or 10 born the amount of money bigger and bigger, because we didn't do the right thing today. So I'm asking you, I'm pleading with you to look at the PCA issue and do not cut anymore. I beg you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kurt. Mr. Chair and committee members, I'd just like to briefly follow up. If you noticed in the newsletter that we handed out, there's a story on Griffin Asher, who's an individual that is receiving PCA services, and fortunately in his assessment is able to keep those services. But other persons with disabilities are going to be greatly impacted. I just checked in with ARC Greater Twin Cities, and they've received recently over 50 phone calls asking for advocacy and support in dealing with some of the PCA changes. And keep in mind, the ARC does not receive any government funding for its advocacy efforts. This is done through the donations that we get in a variety of ways. And we're needing to support persons. One of the points that Representative Hosh highlighted in his opening comments were that there was planning to be done for alternative services for these individuals that was to be completed in 2011. If we accelerate these cuts and move them up to 2010, that those alternatives will not be developed, and we're going to leave those persons without the supports and services that they need. There's close to 2,000 people that it's estimated that these cuts will impact when we implement the 2ADL eligibility requirement, and those most hurt by these will be people with cognitive limitations such as traumatic brain injury, Down syndrome, dementia, and children and adults affected by mental illnesses. Another group that's going to be impacted, and last week when we had testimony in the policy committee, I met a family that came. It was a mother and her adult daughter that have adopted 7 children with disabilities. And part of their agreement in adopting those children was to receive a certain level of PCA services. Those services are now being cut, and they're being impacted greatly in their ability to care for those 7 adopted children. So we ask you to look at these PCA cuts. We know that there is going to be cuts in these in the future. We would hope that we don't accelerate these cuts and that we should be looking at other areas of the budget and taking a balanced approach to the very difficult challenges that we have this year. Thank you very much for this opportunity to share our thoughts.
Thank you. Questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. Next is Ethan Roberts. Oh, there. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Huntley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ethan Roberts. I'm the director of the Twin Cities Jewish Community Government Affairs Program at the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and Dakotas, which might make me have the longest title of anyone in this room. There's an old saying that, especially at this point in the hearing, everything that needs to be said has probably already been said, but not everyone's had a chance to say it. So with that in mind, I'll really try to be brief here and just pick up on things which I don't think have been explicitly discussed. And in terms of, you know, looking at the situation that you're in, which is certainly not enviable at all, and I know that all the choices are bad, I would humbly suggest that you step back for a second and think about the fact that not all funding sources are equal in terms of their ability to leverage outside resources. And so that when we're speaking about cuts to long-term care, be it through waivered services or through skilled nursing facilities, which are funded through Medicaid, remember, and I'm sure you all know this, that this is a 50-50 match outside of, you know, stimulus years with the federal government. And so that the cuts that you make to that, although they help with the state budget shortfall, maximize even greater pain in terms of loss of federal dollars, and if something isn't done with rate equalization, with private dollars. And this all leads back to, I think, which is the bigger problem, beyond the budget. The budget deficit is a symptom of a poor economy. And the economy is poor because of unemployment and underemployment. And I know there's a lot of discussion the government doesn't create jobs. I represent nonprofits. The number of the people I represent work, about 1,000 of them, work for the government. But nonetheless, government funding is an important part of our budgets. And so when these kind of cuts goes through, and I'm sure that they will, you can't tax our way out of this problem, that's for sure, that also impacts jobs. And so whatever you can do to minimize the harm to Minnesota workers, I think you should do. Whatever you can do to minimize the loss of outside resources, be it from the federal government or private resources, I think you should do that as well. So those are the two suggestions I would humbly submit to this committee as you go about the very difficult work that you have in terms of making this budget balance.
Thank you. Questions? Well, James, thank you again for your testimony. And next is Michelle Kimball from AARP and Heidi Holste. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It will just be me representing AARP. I appreciate the opportunity to be before the committee today. I am here, as you know, representing nearly 700,000 consumers across the state of Minnesota, and that's roughly about 3,000 to 6,000 individuals over the age of 50 in each of your house districts. We are concerned about two fundamental things in this particular proposal. The first being the proposal to repeal rate equalization. Our members are exceptionally concerned about that. Hopefully you have all been hearing from your constituents about this. I know that thousands have contacted the legislature and the governor's office in the last week alone, and hopefully you will continue to hear from them. Folks are very, very concerned about it because it would result in a major cost shift, as you know, to residents who pay their own care. And most importantly, it would have a significant and long-term implication for the quality of care on our most vulnerable population. And I want to address that directly because I know the arguments have been that there are only two states in the country that currently have rate equalization, Minnesota and North Dakota, and no one else has it. And my question to you is not why does Minnesota have rate equalization and the rest don't, but why don't the other states have rate equalization? Why aren't they following Minnesota? And I want to give you a couple of examples of just what is happening in some of the other states that do not have rate equalization and what has happened here in Minnesota and North Dakota because of rate equalization. One of the things we are very concerned, if you repeal rate equalization, what could happen here in Minnesota, especially after year three. I mean, we understand that over the next 3 years, the repeal of rate equalization is phased in, but after that, there is no cap on what private pay, what the cap would be on private pay. Nursing homes could, in effect, especially for-profit nursing homes, charge whatever they want, and there is absolutely no guarantee that that money would be used to improve quality care. There's no guarantee of quality. I will give you a very good example of how this works in another state. A story, and it comes directly from Dr. Bob Kane, who is the long-term care chair for the University of Minnesota, widely known nationwide. He placed his own mother in a nursing home in New York State. No equalization law there. She was a private pay resident. She paid more than $300 a day. Medicaid rate was less than half of that. He was very concerned. One of the questions he asked the administrator when he checked his mother in was, what does she get for this additional dollar? She paid nearly twice as much. And he said absolutely nothing. She was paying twice as much for the exact same care. What he was very concerned about, and unfortunately she passed away about 90 days after being admitted to the nursing home, but what he was most concerned about was, even though he was assured that his mother was getting the same care, standard of care, as a Medicaid recipient, what he was afraid of was that once she went off private pay and exhausted her resources, that her care would be less. And he was very worried about that. And that's a real life story. I will tell you what else could happen in Minnesota. There could be two levels of care, not only directly in one particular nursing home, but among nursing homes. A good example is in Wisconsin. One of my staff members had a step-grandmother who recently passed away. She was a private pay resident in a nursing home in Wisconsin. She was in a private pay facility, and once her private pay dollars were exhausted, she was no longer allowed, or I should say a room was no longer available for her in that private pay residence. She was forced to move to a Medicaid home where the care was significantly worse than what she was receiving in the private pay home in Wisconsin. Another concern that we have is that if rate equalization is repealed in one particular nursing home, there obviously is an incentive for any nursing home to bring in more private pay dollars, because that will bring more dollars into the system. And let's not kid ourselves, this is all about additional money. If you have a private pay resident, and that private pay individual is in a single bed, and private pay is exhausted, and individuals will pay down significantly faster, what then happens to that individual? Do you think that they will be able to stay in that single room at the Medicaid rate? I bet, as what has happened in Ohio, that that individual would be moved from a single bed to a double room, simply because they are a Medicaid recipient. That currently does not happen in the state of Minnesota. We are also very concerned about only private pay residents, nursing homes being created, and then only Medicaid homes being created. And while there is a mix out there in other states, that is the reality in other states. You have only Medicaid homes and you have only private pay homes. And as was shown in Wisconsin, if you spend down in a private pay home, where do you go from there? The quality of care is not the same. Texas is an excellent example of that. Yes, there are federal regulations that require certain levels of care and certain things must be done. They're not always followed, and that's why we have regulators, and that's why you have checks on nursing homes. Texas is an excellent example of poor quality care based on private pay homes versus Medicaid homes, and the fact that there's a significant differentiation in the quality of care within that state because of that. I also want to point out, in the top five private pay states in the country, Alaska, Connecticut, New York, Massachusetts, Hawaii, the charges to residents, our private pay residents, are more than $100 a day in those states. In Hawaii, for example, or Alaska, for example, private pay residents are charged $515 a day versus and that's a difference of $131 from the Medicaid rate. In Connecticut, private pay is charged $345 a day, which is a difference of $134 from the Medicaid rate. in Massachusetts, which has a Medicaid rate similar to ours here in Minnesota, it's higher. It's $187 a day. The private pay rate is $109 more per day per private pay resident. They charge the private pay residents $296 a day for the same care. So we are very concerned, one, that that isn't fair, and two, you're asking middle-class individuals, we're not talking about the rich here, middle-class individuals who work their whole lives, have done the right thing, have saved their dollars, you're asking them to pay significantly more and spend down much faster, which we believe is going to be at a higher cost to the state. Now, we know that there is not a fiscal note at this time on the repeal of rate equalization, but there was one on a repeal that was offered by Representative Fran Bradley back in 2006. We believe strongly that even though there isn't a huge cost over the next 3 years to the state, once that cap is lifted, there could be a very large cost to the state because of the repeal of rate equalization, because people will have to spend down faster, because they will go on Medicaid sooner. So we ask that you look at this in the long term and consider that. Finally, I do want to say that we are in absolute agreement with the imperative opposing rate cuts to nursing homes and to home health care entities for the simple reason that we believe those cuts would directly impact the quality of care. Now, I know that there was a question asked that what do we do if we don't cut nursing homes? Or if we don't make those cuts across the board, what kind of solutions do you have? I don't have direct solutions, but I do have a voice here, and I want to bring that voice out. We know that the governor has indicated that there will be no new taxes, but I do want to inform the committee that the public is willing to pay more in order to maintain long-term care services. Last year, in 2009, AARP and the Long-Term Care Imperative did a survey. We surveyed more than 1,000 individuals in the state of Minnesota over the age of 18. And here were two key results. First, to avoid cuts in long-term care services for older people and people with disabilities, at least 7 in 10 Minnesotans support increasing taxes on households earning more than $250,000 annually and increasing taxes on cigarettes, liquor, beer, and wine. And second, to avoid cuts in long-term care services for older people and people with disabilities, at least 6 in 10 Minnesotans support closing loopholes and exemptions and allowing more state-run casinos and expanding gaming. So what this shows is that while the governor may not be behind finding additional revenue sources, the public, at least the majority of the public, is. And so we know that those are not solutions that you're willing to put on the table at the moment, but it is something to consider that the majority of Minnesotans over the age of 18 want to maintain long-term care services for the elderly, and they are willing to pay a little bit more in order to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. We're not going to have time for questions. We have two more people left. Jane Okramowitz, and if you could keep it really short, because we're actually over our time already.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee members, good afternoon. My name is Jane Okramowicz, and I'm the president of the Seniors and Workers for Quality Coalition, and I'd like to note that that's what we're here representing today. I also volunteer with the Alzheimer's Association, and I've been a consumer of long-term care for my mother, who was in a skilled nursing facility for 7 years with Alzheimer's disease. As a representative of the Seniors and Workers for Equality Coalition, the people at the heart of long-term care, we are challenging several of the provisions in this. And I must say that the first point that I had made in committee last week about the $50 fee for nursing assistants, the registration fee, I'm delighted to hear today that that is not permitted under federal law. So I will let it go at that, and as far as that particular point is concerned.
Last week you also heard from Mr. McAvey that he and his wife, who have saved all their lives, worked very, very hard. We're currently, and she is with, has Alzheimer's disease and is in a skilled care facility. They have long-term care insurance, which pays $2,700 a month, but they are paying $6,900 a month for their services. I did the quick calculations as we were talking today, and at the 2% of what they are paying, that the fee would be increased, it would be $1,700 the first year, the 4% the second year, $3,400 an increase for the year, and we're talking about significant money by the time we get to year three at the 6%, and of course, as Michelle Kimball just stated, there is no limits after that. So we're talking an increase of at least $5,000 a year, and I really would say that I can't see how that was not going to spend down faster as far as their limited retirement income is concerned. And our concern, of course, that it does support that increase will not bring in a better, more stable work or quality, well-trained staff to provide care. The greatest concern for us, though, is in eliminating rate equalization. And right now, Michelle Kimball, again, has from AARP, has given you many of the arguments that we are particularly concerned with. But what we would add to that is that I would say it would be very, very difficult for you to say to me that facilities are not going to be picking people that they admit based upon ability to pay versus will they be on medical assistance. And the reason, the federal law says they cannot receive less quality of care, but it does not say that they are not going to be looked at on whether or not they can pay for that care themselves on it. It does regulate, we feel, consumers more than providers, and there were some things that were taken out already, so I won't address that part. But we do think that this is a new surtax on seniors who have been able to save some money for their care until their savings are gone while imposing fees on others, but we're happy to hear today will not. Sincerely hope the committee will not vote favorably on this bill in its present form, and even amending it will leave many dire circumstances. I thank you for the opportunity to express our concerns, and we're ready to provide any answers that we have.
Well, we have one speaker left to go, and then we're already 5 minutes over. So thank you for your testimony. And David Hancock? Nope, not here. Okay.
Sarah Lawrence?
She's not going to talk. Representative Hodge.
Well, thank you to the committee, and thank you for all the testifiers. Just to reiterate that something that we already know, but we are faced with between the worst of decisions and bad decisions. And in this bill, I think some of the components of this bill are the worst of some of the decisions we might have to make. So hopefully we don't have to make them. But we have to have an understanding of how our decisions are going to impact people. And we're learning a little bit more. We're learning information from the department because of this bill. We're able to run some different numbers and see the fiscal impacts and where we might be able to save some money. And hopefully we can continue down the road of having a discussion, having our questions answered. But everybody needs to know. Members of the House, members of the public, the whole works need to know that if we are expected to take the substantial brunt of cuts in Health and Human Services, what that's going to mean. And we need to have an understanding that there is a difference between general fund cuts and other components of this budget. And the governor makes $193 million of general fund cuts. And once you exceed that amount, once you exceed $200 million, the options are very, very dire for many people. And I hope that we don't have to do them. I hope we can be judicious in what we do. But this is going to be, if we think today's bad, it's... The next few weeks and months are going to only be more difficult. So thank you for the committee's time.
Representative Gottwald, very briefly.
Well, Mr. Chair, committee members, Representative Hodge, I understand what you're trying to do with this bill. It's a little frustrating, though, because as much as everybody needs to know what our decisions might do, we need to also get past admiring the problem and putting together global solutions. And I don't see the place where that's happening right now bipartisanly. We have some very tough decisions to make, as you pointed out, and we actually have to get about doing them, bringing forward proposals that actually accomplish them in a responsible way. This bill doesn't do that. It makes some good points, but it doesn't do that. And rather than spend more time admiring the problem and the potential impacts, which I agree everybody should know, we need to start solving the problem. We don't have a lot of time.
Okay, Mr. Chair. As the author of the bill, I really want to respond to that. Author a bill, Representative Gottwald, author a bill and put your name on it and put ideas behind these cuts. This is difficult work, and this isn't to admire the problem. I admire nothing we have to do, but we have to have an understanding of it. And if we want to talk about providing solutions, this is a possible solution. As painful as it is, it's a possible solution. And I'm willing to put my name behind it. I'm willing to take the criticism and be able to get the input of the public. So I hope we can have bipartisan solutions. And bipartisan solutions require taking responsibility and offering solutions in the process.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I'm going to respond. I've put my name on bills that have just as much interest in getting fiscal notes and analysis that actually save money, that show reform, hundreds of millions of dollars that we left laying on the table that you haven't taken up. We haven't heard more than a handful of Republican bills in this entire session so far. Where is the bipartisan effort to bring forward good ideas from both sides of the aisle to solve this problem? Instead, we spend time looking at bills that admire the problem and don't solve it. So with all due respect, I have put my name on bills, I know others have as well, that provide real solutions, real possibilities, real reforms, and those bills are going nowhere. So as long as we're pointing fingers and talking about the problems we face, let's start talking. And again, my point is, where is the bipartisanship? Good ideas from both sides of the aisle being accepted and worked on together to find a solution. It's not happening.
House file 2614 is late over her.
3442.
Oh, wrong one. 3442 is late over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and the meeting is adjourned.